This episode is proudly brought to you by Leica Cameras and their cutting-edge SL platform. Please stay tuned for more details about a new trade-in program and a special Black Friday bundle with Peak Design, or visit bit.ly/LeicaSLCamera for more information. Hey, it's me, James Stacey, and today we're digging into one of the most commonly asked questions, how do I, that's you, get into writing about watches? To shine a light on an unconventional career path, I've collected two of Hodinkee's heaviest hitters, Ben and Jack, both of whom came to this wacky world via two very different trajectories. From traditional journalism to the hallowed halls of enthusiast press and everything in between, we get into the origins of this calling, how it's changed with the advent of the internet, and even offer some practical advice for those of you who might want to break free of a normal 9-to-5 for a career that I promise few of your family or peers will ever understand. Also, a quick heads up, this episode has a bit more bad language than normal. You've been warned, and let's get to it. Ben, Jack, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you both back on.
Yeah, whatever. It's great to see you guys.
It's great to see you guys too. I don't really have a follow-up to that.
So yeah, we're digging into kind of what it is to get into watch writing. It's kind of a weird job to aspire to get into, but and yet it, all three of us kind of landed here at some level, some more intentionally than others. I think it's probably helps to understand if we want to know where we are now, maybe know where we started. Jack, you want to give us a little bit of a background on your sort of origin story in writing about watches, being involved in this pursuit?
I mean, I love the phrase origin story because it implies that both Ben and I were bitten by radioactive watches at some point in the not too distant past.
As a radium leak, yeah.
Could be.
That's good.
For me, I feel like my... sort of interests were kind of circling around what I've ended up doing for the last 10 years, probably starting when I was about like 7 or 8 years old and I first sort of like noticed watches and got interested in watches. But it really got started back in the early 2000s, not earlier than then actually, late 1990s when I was spending a lot of time hanging around flea markets and I was collecting fountain pens at the time because, number one, collecting fountain pens was and still is actually a hell of a lot cheaper than collecting watches. And fountain pens are mechanically really simple, so if you found one that was broken, it was trivially easy to repair. And watches are not trivially easy to repair, but I found a broken one, a pocket watch, sitting in the drawer of a desk that somebody was trying to sell at the 26th Street flea market. And I asked him how much for the watch, and of course he was trying to sell the desk, and he was like, I will let you buy that watch for $5 just to get you out of my face because you're definitely not going to buy the desk. So I bought the watch and I took it home, and it sat there for probably 6 months. And then I started wondering, like, and I'd never really thought of it before because by then, you know, quartz watches and digital watches had been around, you know, basically forever. You know, but I started wondering, like, how does this machine keep time? And I managed to get on a couple of discussion forums on Usenet news groups. That's how long ago this was. And I found some watchmakers, kind of miraculously, who were like, okay, like, here's how you take the back off of this watch without, like, destroying it because, like, clearly you're an idiot. I mean, nobody has contempt for people who don't know anything like watchmakers have contempt for people who don't know anything. And it took me about 6 months, but I managed to get the back off the darn thing. I still have it, by the way. It's a 125-year-old Waltham. And I managed to get the back off of it, and I managed to figure out what tools to buy, which was really tricky. I had to buy them from a jobber out in California, and I managed to take the thing apart, put it back together, and get it running again without destroying it, you know, which is proof of that, like, miracles can occur if anything is. And, you know, it was keeping time to within 10 seconds a day, which for a 125-year-old watch with a completely blown mainspring is not too bad. And I thought to myself, well, that's really cool. I mean, that moment when you see something that old that you've touched with your own hands start to tick, you know, it's like a Frankenstein moment.
Sure.
Right? Like,
what have I done?
Yeah. I should have thought that. But I'm sure you guys both know the feeling, like something that you have, brought back to life with your own hands that's like over a century old, like, you know, it starts ticking again and you're like, I've created life. And you get this like little burst of serotonin and you're like, I would like to create life again. And that's really how it started.
And do you remember your first step into taking that kind of serotonin hit and then wanting to feed it back out into the world by, you know, putting it into words and sentences and such. What was the first piece you wrote or gig you had in the space?
Man, it was really arguing with watches about people on Usenet news groups. And I mean, if anybody is really seriously interested in digging some of those arguments up, I'm sure that they still exist because like Usenet news groups are archived somewhere. It'd be interesting to know where. I found out that there were a lot of people who shared this same like weird ass obsession, you know, that I had. And I think that's like the great thing about the internet. Well, one of the very few great things about the internet is that you can find people who are as bizarre as you are, you know, whether your interest is writing like My Little Pony fan fiction or watches, which were kind of like morally and technically equivalent back in 1998, you know, you can find people who share the same interests. And it was, I think, that like wonderful moment where you realize that being interested in watches isn't this like weird thing that happens in magazines that are published six times a year. It's something that can actually happen in real time between real people. And you know, that was exciting and validating.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah. Ben, any similarities with kind of your earliest days in deciding to, again, take what I assume was a great level of fascination and start putting it into words and maybe organizing it online?
Zero relationship there to Jack's origin story at all. No. But, you know, effectively, like, I wanted to do something really different with my life than what I was currently doing at the time, which was kind of a project manager within the financial industry. I loved to write. I was never really given a platform to write, or I should say I never really asked for a platform to write. And, you know, for me, it was just doing something creative that felt so different than what I was really doing professionally at the time, which again was like spreadsheets and PowerPoint presentations, et cetera. And it was just a wonderful thing. So for me, you know, and none of you please take this wrong way, either you guys as coworkers or your listeners out there, like Hodinkee for me was really a means to kind of flex my writing ability and maybe someday get into a journalism program, which I did, obviously. And when I was accepted into grad school, I said, okay, like I'm good now. You know, I can stop writing about watches. I obviously didn't. And I kind of fell more deeply in love with the category and the space. But I think for me, I'd say the greatest thing that ever happened for me was not being aware of the watch writers that came before me. Because if I were, I would probably try to have emulated a Jack Forrester or Joe Thompson or Walt Odets or whoever. The one guy that I was, you know, I learned about early on in my kind of like interest in watches was Chuck Maddox. And weirdly, he, I believe, passed away the month that Hodinkee went online, which is kind of a strange thing. But, you know, he was interested in the same stuff that I was, which was like at the time, like vintage chronographs, mostly tool watches. And so Chuck Maddox was one of the guys that kind of like he was an early blogger, so to speak. But I was, as I said, kind of blissfully unaware of what Watch Time Revolution, even the purest time zone were up to at that time. And I think because of that, I was just doing what made me happy. And I think I was just writing about the stuff that interested me. And I think that is surely the best way to make a name for yourself in the watch space or really any enthusiast market. Is like if you genuinely care about something, you're gonna want to spend more time doing it. And all I wanted to do for, you know, the first 5+ years of Hodinkee was just like learn about and then write about watches. And if, you know, the money, the you know, the whatever, the fame, the glory that came after that was not even an idea. Like that wasn't why we were there at all. Like I didn't know what press trips were. I didn't know what any of this stuff was. So I was just there to tell stories about watches. And I was obviously incredibly fascinated with watches. But, you know, again, my original goal was to be a writer, full stop. Didn't have to be about watches at all. And if you go back into the internet archives, you know, 12, 13 years ago, like you'll see me writing about, I wrote for the literary blog on Forbes with our friend Hannah Elliott. I wrote for Ask Men about, you know, fashion and cars and restaurants. You know, I just wanted to be a journalist. And then, you know, watches were a fascination, but I frankly didn't think that I would ever make a dollar writing about watches because how could you possibly make a dollar writing about watches, you know?
You know, I have to say, Ben, I think that's where there is actually considerable overlap in both of our early experiences of writing about watches. I mean, the first time I got paid 25 cents a word for writing about watches, I was like, well, that's
weird. Yeah, totally. And it's so funny you mentioned like 25 cents per word. I remember in the early days, that was really a thing, is how much you get paid per word. And, you know, I remember Dan Neal, who was a Pulitzer Prize winning automotive journalist. I remember being on a car press junket. And everyone was like, oh my God, did you hear that Dan Neal now makes $1.50 a word? And it's just like, just the idea of like $1.50 a word is so funny. Now, and to be clear, I don't know him and I'm sure he probably makes far more than that now, but it was just so funny to be talking about, you know, dollars per words back then. And that was really how you were kind of like, you were judged as a journalist, is what you got paid per word. And thankfully that is no longer the case.
Yeah, that has kind of gone away in the last few years. That's been my experience. But it was like that when I first got my start. It was, you know, you had a rate and either they offered you a rate card or they asked you what your rate was. And that was your little moment of negotiation. And then you basically, you're in for whatever number you had established. And I think that's one of those kind of interesting lessons that I'm not sure necessarily the same now. But when you guys got started, and do you remember any specific lessons that you kind of absorbed then that even kind of pay off now, or you know, maybe you do a little bit less writing than you did at one point, or considerably less, depending on the scope. But any of that you kind of carry with you that you felt are something you would pass on to someone?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, look, I'm a particular type of professional where if I don't care about something, I will do a very poor job covering it. As I think, you know, James, I hate to say, you might be one of those guys too.
It's a major flaw, but it's true.
No doubt. And likewise. And so, you know, like when I found something that fascinated me, Ben, you know, as an individual, I would crush it. And so I think back to like the early Paul Newman stuff. And when Stephen Queen's watch sold in like 2008, I thought I did a really good job with. And, you know, I was obsessed, and I mean obsessed, with these really early Daytona 6239 double Swiss underline watches. There's a story still online on Houdinki that was just like just a fucking nerd out on this thing. And Eric Clapton's Platinum 2499, which is one of the first videos that our colleague Will Holloway did for Houdinki. And like, really, you know, and I still think like, and this is not me saying this, I think you guys, you know, you guys at large will say and see this, like when I'm excited about something, like you can sense it, you can feel it in my writing. And when Jack is excited about something, you can sense it in his writing. And I think the same would be true for you, James. And I think like, we love this stuff at times. These are jobs. And I think like, that's the first kind of like misconception with working at Houdinki or working anywhere in this space. Like this is a job, you know, and like we all do shit we don't want to do. I was just in an incredibly annoying, you know, a Zoom call right before this. I won't say with who, but like, this is work, you know? And so, yes, we do get to travel around the world and see beautiful things and write about wonderful objects that we love. But, you know, when the stars align to present you with an object that you were just fascinated by on a personal level, the writing comes alive. And I've seen it with Jack with, you know, his stuff on the Datagraph. And I remember, I think it was actually before we worked together. In fact, I know it was, you wrote a story about the Datagraph for Forbes Life, I think, which was just, I think it was a cover story, wasn't it, Jack?
Oh, this is going back to a time where my memory is not as accurate as it used to be, but I think you're right.
Okay. I think it was a cover story for Forbes Life. And I remember reading that story and I was like, wow, like this is how you write about a watch in a magazine, you know? And, you know, it comes down to like, for me, personal interest. And, you know, if James, if you want me to do, you know, a 10,000 word story on the 2526 only in white metals, like I could do that. And I would do it with a smile on my face if I had the time, you know? But if you want me to write about something else, like it would be a real struggle for me. So for me, you know, it's the stupid adage, like, you know, if you do what you love, like you never work a day in your life, like that can be true. And like, I wrote a story for our site not long ago, 2 weeks ago, about the watches coming up at auction. And like, I pinged all of our collective boss here, Nick Marino, who's our SVP of content, and said, hey dude, like I'm writing this thing. Like, are you okay with that? And he's like, of course, you know, like I just woke up on a Saturday and I wanted to do it. And that's the type of writing that I think produces the best results.
You know, there's a part of me that wants to say, listen, guys, if, you know, like anybody out there who's like in their 20s and wants to start out as a watch writer, like, you know, consciously work at being a good generalist. And like, there's definitely some upside to that. But the truth is, like, that's not what got Ben the success that he's had as a watch writer. And it's not what got me my success as a watch writer either. Like, the truth is, both of us, you know, and I think Ben's absolutely right. Like, both of us made our bones, to borrow a mafia expression, when we started out writing about things that we really cared about, writing about things that we really loved. And like, one of the things that Ben just said now that really resonates with me is the whole idea of like being a professional, right? Like, you know, if you're a journalist, you have, before anything else, you have a sense of responsibility to your craft as a journalist. And like, there's probably no more debased word than like journalist, especially, you know, when it comes to consumer journalism. But like, the reality is, like, if you're a carpenter, you take pride in being able to measure and cut accurately. And if you're a writer, you should be able to take pride, like, no matter what you're covering, you should be able to say to yourself, I wrote good sentences, you know, but before whatever the subject matter is, it's good to have an instinct for what a good sentence is, and it's good to have like a real commitment to that. But at the same time, like, you can't fake genuine love for what you're writing about. And like, we love this, like the three of us, you know, like me, you, James, and you, Ben, like, we love these like weird little objects for some reason. Like, they, for some reason, they just like strike a spark in us. And like, it's, you know, it's true that like that when that actually happens, it really comes across.
And do you think that the job, the role, the scope of it has even changed that much in, say, the last 10 years? Or is it kind of the same stuff that would have worked in forming your base in this world would work to form someone's base now?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think the environment's changed dramatically, right? Like, I mean, you know, 99% of watch discourse when I started writing about watches happened in print. And nowadays, 99%, you know, I mean, obviously 99% of watch discourse happens now on the internet. So the environment's changed. We all live our lives like much, much more publicly. You know, I mean, if like Ben writes something or you write something or I write something, you know, we're going to hear about it from like 50,000 people we don't know over like a 24-hour period, which is, you know, which is weird. But the basic, I think the basics still apply. Like good writing is always good writing. Good storytelling is always good storytelling. And like, you know, when somebody discovers, I don't know, like, I mean, I'm never going to discover the history of the Omega Speedmaster Professional for the first time ever again. Like that happened for me once. And speaking to Chuck Maddox, it happened because of Chuck Maddox. Like it happened not entirely because of him, but a lot because of him. Out there, there are people who are discovering like the Omega Speedmaster Professional for the first time. They're discovering how cool the history of the GMT Master is for the first time. There are like, you know, serious mechanism nerds out there who are discovering like how an escapement works for the first time. And they're like, oh, that's how a watch works? There's this like bizarre thing called an escapement with these like weird little pieces that interact with each other in this way that it took me 3 days of like nonstop mental effort to understand, but like now I get it. Like that stuff is still happening. And that's actually like, that's not a bad thing. It's one of the things that makes like starting to write about watches actually like fun and exciting. And like, you know, Ben before was talking about how valuable it was for him to kind of like not know who had come before and to just like, you know, do his own thing, like right from the outset and not try to imitate anybody. And like, I mean, I think one of the things that like writers do, no matter what kind of writing it is, whether it's like writing fiction or writing nonfiction or writing about watches, like it's a really dangerous thing to know who your ancestors are, because you can waste 10 years of your life trying to imitate them before you realize that you shouldn't be trying to imitate them.
That's exactly it. I've seen it even within our own team, you know, in our company Slack saying, oh, we're not going to cover X, Y, and Z because so-and-so wrote about it 2 years ago. And it's like, sure. But I mean, I understand that, and it's a story that fundamentally changed that is somewhat sound, but not even. I think that there's so many different vantage points out there. And I think what's frustrating, obviously, is when people do exactly what you've done before, or when we do something exactly that somebody said before. But Jack and I being completely different types of writers and completely different type of, you know, kind of air quotes experts, I think is, you know, we're great archetypes here. Because like if you wrote a story, let's say Jack is assigned to write an in-depth story on the long zone datagraph. He would talk about the column wheel. He would talk about the construction. He'd talk to Anthony de Haas. It would be a very technical piece. If I had wrote about the datagraph, which you know, obviously we both have, it would be much more about, you know, how it came to be, what it means to collectors, why it languished you know, under retail for so long and now it's surging. Like, you know, there's different perspectives on anything, on everything. And then there are people that's a little bit of both. And then there are people that only care about only the movement. And then some people only care about collecting. And I think, you know, it's just a matter of kind of putting your own spin on things. And obviously the people that have succeeded the most in this space have really come to approach things from a totally different angle. And now I think there's a lot of, you know, wannabe Jack Forresters out there. And I think there's a lot of like, you know, guys focused on collecting and all that. And I'm not saying we're the first at all, but I think, you know, if you want to succeed in this space, you have to take a fresh angle. Like, you know, for better or worse, Hodinkee has covered a lot of shit in its 13 years, you know, and, you know, a lot of it isn't even online anymore. But like, you know, if you're going to talk about a space dweller, like talk about something new on the space dweller, talk about like some new information, you know, being the first to put it online is no longer enough, you know?
This week's episode is proudly brought to you by one of my favorite brands, Leica Camera. Day in and day out, Leica has been making cutting-edge optics for over 100 years, and a huge part of their legacy comes from actively supporting photographers with an always-evolving range of tools that focus on the essentials and passion for photography. So, if it's time for an upgrade and you've been eyeing the full-frame mirrorless SL2 or SL2S camera bodies as the tool for your next photo or video project, Leica is keen to sweeten the deal with their recently launched trade-in program, which runs from now until January 31st, 2022, and a complimentary Peak Design bundle being offered for Black Friday on purchases made between November 24th and December 1st of this year. Designed specifically for Leica, this bundle includes Peak Design's popular 20-liter bag, a strap, and a clutch hand strap, all designed to help you get the most from your new SL2 or SL2S mirrorless camera body. The SL2 and SL2S cameras represent unparalleled pro performance with up to 47 megapixels of resolution, 4K video, in-body stabilization, lightning-fast autofocus, and the ability to mount a wide range of lenses, including the SL system and Leica's iconic M mount. Check the show notes for links or visit bit.ly/LeicaSLCamera for more information. And now, back to the show. And, you know, you're talking about these traits that you've seen in people that have some longevity, aside from having a personal take, which in, at least for me, took years of others, yourself and Jack and Stephen and people working with me to...
I'm sorry, who was the last one?
Stephen.
Oh, right. The guy, that guy, sure. Yeah.
Well, he's the reason I was made my way to Hodinkee. And then, you know, folks have invested in me to find a point, and Nick now is still doing it, to find a point where I can operate almost exclusively from my own sort of perspective. And also I've had the time for that perspective, I hope, to have some sort of value in that it's different from others. At sort of a more general level, you know, we've all been on the same sort of circle of there aren't that many people in the game, all things considered. What do you see any kind of universal traits that gives folks some longevity in the space? Not just the quality of the writing or their interest in watches, but other skills that people should have on their mind if they want to jump into this pool.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first trait is that we're all a bunch of dorks. And I mean, like, I say that jokingly, but like, that is 100% true.
It's actually true.
It's so true.
Yeah, like, we've dedicated our lives to talking about things that, like, truly nobody needs at all. And in fact, like, maybe the world may or may not be better without. I think that's, you know, uniting here. But I think a lot of it, and, you know, I know we've talked about this a lot in the past, James, and with some other writers, like, I want people to be able to understand that, like, the equation of what the kind of brands need, what collectors need, what we as journalists, like, we're all looking to accomplish something. And sometimes those kind of ideas align and sometimes they don't. And I think navigating that is really, really difficult. And there are some fantastically knowledgeable experts, I'm going to call them experts out there, that may or may not be able to turn a word, that don't know how to kind of understand the different stakeholders within the watch world. And again, there's collectors, there's retailers, brands, distributors, there's so many people at stake here. And I think it's really important that people come in with respect for all sides of that. And I think that sometimes I've seen a lot of people kind of burn out really quickly because they didn't acknowledge that, like, some other folks in the equation exist.
I mean, I think that Ben's absolutely right. Like, you want to be able to deliver, like, the most important stakeholder obviously is the reader. If you're a writer, if you're writing about watches or cars or, you know, whatever it is, the most important stakeholder is the reader. But there are a lot of other people whose livelihood might depend on what you write. And, you know, I've, like, talked to critics who write about cars. I've talked to restaurant critics. Like, you know, like, a restaurant critic can destroy a restaurant. A restaurant critic can destroy, like, 5 years of work in somebody's life and, you know, endless meetings that they have had to try to raise money to open a restaurant that they didn't want to have because, like, honestly, they'd rather be back in the kitchen cooking than, like, talking to investors. But, like, it's not about flattering people, and it's not about, like, playing footsie with brands, and it's not about, like, you know, trying to suck up to, like, the PR officer or suck up to the, you know, to the marketing department. It's just about, like, realizing that, like, where everybody who works in the watch industry, every single person who works in the watch industry, they could probably be making more money working someplace else. Like, people work in the watch industry because they care about watches.
Except for you, James. James, you're making the most you possibly can right here. Don't go anywhere. We love you.
I think that might actually be true. I was about to jump in. I didn't want to step on it. Yeah, no, I don't think I have any skill set outside of this space, really.
Like, it's a weird business. It's a very small business. Like, everybody knows everybody. And just, like, having what you do be leavened by a certain basic respect for, like, the humanity and hard work of the other people who are in the same business you are, I think that's really, really, really important. And, you know, especially when on the internet, like, you know, there's this whole idea that hostility is conflated with honesty. Like, you're not being, like, somehow you're being dishonest if you're not being, like, gratuitously hostile and negative on a regular basis. And it's just, like, first of all, it's not true. Secondly, that's a terrible presumption to bring in if you're a critic of anything, whether it's restaurants or watches or cars or whatever. You know, and thirdly, it's like, you know, there are other human beings out there who are trying to, you know, they're basically trying to make the world a better place for the same thing that you're trying to make the world a better place for, which is loving watches and appreciating watches. And, you know, like, there are times when we're all our own worst enemy. But you don't. What you want to do is, I think, what you want to do as much as you can is just recognize that we're all kind of trying to do the same thing, and that doesn't mean that you should say that, like, a watch is great if you think it's a shit watch. It doesn't mean that you know should say that you think a design is great if you think it's, like, a terrible design. I mean, like, we've all seen designs that look like you know, basically, oh, you look at this design, you see it yourself. Okay, so clearly what happened was the design team wanted to take an early lunch on this one. You know, like it happens, but just sort of understanding the common ground we all have, you know, like to Ben's point, I think is like, I think it makes a difference. And it's one of the things that gives a person longevity as a writer, as a content creator in this space.
In my mind, the thing that has always stood out, and I definitely learned this from a lot of the core team at Hodinkee, but then I was listening to a podcast recently with a buddy of mine, Johnny, who's a prolific car writer, Johnny Lieberman. And he was saying that when he first got into car writing, his kind of mentor laid out the kind of balance between positivity and negativity in a review. And he said, look, when I come to any car, and this is how I feel about watches, I want to love it. So if I end up not being able to love it, that's worth highlighting. But anything outside of that it can essentially form something that's not that valuable to someone who does love it or to the audience at large. And I think that's a neat way of looking at it. You know, I'm curious because I want to keep some level, like I like the idea that someone listening to this might be able to get some motivation to start their own thing or to invest in something or whatever. And do you guys figure the move today would be to shoot to be the top dog at a major outlet? That would be you, Jack, or sort of start the next major outlet like you, Ben. Do you guys think that there's one path or the other, or it's just going to depend on personality?
Okay. I think I'm an entrepreneur for sure. And I think it would be difficult for me to not be that, you know, but that's certainly not for everybody. And like, you know, I frankly don't know if I would start Hodinkee now again, but you know, for me, I think, you know, it just comes down to the ambition that you really have. And I think the ambition I've always had, as I've said somewhat recently somewhere else, has really been, you know, fairly significant. And like, I never wanted to be the biggest watch, whatever we are in the world. I never wanted to be the best watch writer, which I'm certainly not. So no worries there. I wanted to kind of change things. I wanted to change people's perspective on what something is. And I think, you know, that's the goal that Hodinkee has always had and the goal that I've always had. So, and then there are people that believe in that mission. And if you believe in that mission, then I think working for us or working for somebody like us, I think makes a lot of sense. But everyone is so different. And I think I know some people that just like are completely happy writing about watches, and that's what they do all day and every day. And they've got a good team and life is good. I mean, I always, you know, kind of like wanted something different, and that's certainly not for everybody. In fact, it's not for most people. So it really just comes down to every individual. But I will say that like to make a name for yourself in watch writing right now, I think would be really challenging. I really do. And I think watch writing is one thing, watch personality, that's a different thing. Like we've seen a bunch of YouTubers pop up, you know, over the past few years, and like, you know, they've got a good little thing going. I mean, is that a long-term thing? Who knows? And if YouTube changes their algorithm, or if YouTube, you know, goes into something where it's just not, you know, impactful anymore, then they don't have a job. So I think it depends on what your goals are. But yeah, look, I would encourage every people to try their own thing. I would encourage people to link forces with us or with you know, whoever else in the space. There's a lot of different avenues there. And I think, you know, there are different platforms that offer different things to different people. So it really, you know, this is like the lamest answer ever, but like everyone's different and you just have to figure out what, you know, what makes sense for you.
You know, you just made an interesting distinction, Ben, that I think is worth talking about a little bit more, which is sort of like the difference between a watch personality and a watch writer. And I'm thinking about that right now, you know, and running like seven different, like, you know, parallel tracks of analysis in my brain at the same time. And like, I mean, they seem, on one level, they're really, really different. On another level, over the last, like, I don't know, 3-4 years, maybe, they've become more and more the same thing. And like, I honestly don't know how I feel about that.
Well, I mean, the thing is, you know, and I say this sincerely, like you are a like top tier writer, right? And I think, you know, if YouTube were your medium 20 years ago, I think you would certainly be one of those folks. But like, you have a skill set that is dramatically different than most people, and myself included. Like, I'm a pretty good writer. You're a very good writer. And that there's a huge gap between that. And then there's the people that call themselves writer because they know about watches. And I think, you know, you and I, we've been working together for a long time now. We've come across so many people that are hyper knowledgeable about watches, but cannot turn a sentence to save their life. And being a watch writer is exceedingly difficult. And, you know, creating a word on paper or, you know, on the web that gets people excited is so difficult when there's not, you know, where you don't have the benefit of having a YouTube camera or a video camera on you where you can be super animated. Yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that that is frustrating.
Well, I mean, it's not frustrating necessarily. I just kind of have mixed feelings about it because, I mean, let me analogize to the food writing world, you know, for a little bit. Like, I mean, you go way, way back in the day, you have people who are considered great food writers in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, when like America was first discovering French cooking, right? You had like people like, you know, like James Beard and A.J. Liebling and M.F.K. Fisher. You know, these were people who really kind of like, you know, were considered writing as more kind of fundamental in a certain way to what they were doing than like knowledge about food. And then like, you know, fast forward to, you know, the 2000s and like, and Anthony Bourdain is a really interesting example because he was a fantastic writer, I think. Whether or not he rose to the level of greatness as a writer is, you know, something that people can debate. He was a very, very prolific writer and he was super entertaining. And like the truth is, if you're a writer, you're in the entertainment business and like being entertaining kind of like trumps everything else. But he was super entertaining. He was a great on-screen personality. And he was one of those rare people who was like good on camera, good at the keyboard, and, you know, who I am one of millions of people who wishes that he were still in the business. But like, that's a rare thing. And usually people are good at, you know, like they might be really great on camera. They might be great as a personality, but like putting a sentence together on a page, much less stringing a bunch of sentences together on the page, much less doing that 2 to 3 times a week on a regular basis is like, that's a whole nother thing. But you can't like, I think it's really hard to just be a good writer anymore.
I would also argue that the part that I've seen other people, I've met people who are perfectly capable writers, even talented writers, but couldn't manage all the other stuff that was required to put their writing where it needed to be. They couldn't interface with editors correctly. They're sloppy on emails. They didn't stick to deadlines. You know, copy came in late or wasn't that clean. If you make other people's jobs easier, it can give you more space to have time to become a better writer. And I'm just saying that from my side, I think I've been given better jobs than I necessarily earned just based on my sentences, because I was willing to, you know, get on a phone call and explain myself. I was willing to reply to an email quickly. I didn't miss a deadline. Like some of the simple background craft can really separate those who have something to say and those who end up being able to say it for years.
I think, look, I mean, life is, you know, there are very few roles, jobs in life where like your job is really one thing, you know, it's like, I probably couldn't even come up with one. You know, like everything involves politics to some degree and interpersonal skills. And, you know, the idea that like, if you want to succeed, everyone around you, you know, should want you to succeed as well. Otherwise, you have no chance. And I think that's kind of a hard lesson to be learned by a lot of folks, you know, usually younger folks. But yeah, I mean, look, I think, you know, Jack doesn't exist in a corner by himself, right? Like Jack interacts with you guys and myself and other executives and brand people and like, you know, if Jack was an asshole to people, then Jack wouldn't be Jack, you know? And I think the same is true for me. And you kind of are an asshole to people, and yet you're still, I don't know.
Me?
How you did that. Yeah.
People see the Canadian thing, and I just get away with a lot for sure.
You got to pass. Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, how many well-known people have been taken down in Hollywood and elsewhere simply because they were assholes? And like, people get the schadenfreude and say, you know, like, fuck this guy. You know, like, even if he is talented, like, we're happy to see him fail. And so, yeah, I mean, it's just like being positive. And I think, you know, Jack made a really good point. The idea of like, you know, just being like hyperbolically critical of things like that doesn't show much at all. You know, like we can all be an asshole about anything. Like I'm drinking this stupid polar seltzer cranberry lime thing. Like, this is not my favorite thing. I could rip this thing apart, but like, it's fine. It's just whatever. It's keeping me hydrated right now. Yeah. There's so much more to life than just being good at one thing. And certainly watch writing. Like there's not that many people out there that want to pay anybody to be a watch writer. So like, let's make it friendly and fun and you'll be okay.
Do you guys think it's crucial that you have a skill set beyond writing, whether it's photography or the ability to be a host or maybe background stuff? Let's say you're a really good photo editor, but maybe you don't run a camera or like, because to do something like a Hodinkee thing, you have these multiple vectors. Obviously, you need the words, the paragraphs, the rest of it, and an understanding of how to put that together. But I feel like that's like the roots. The tree kind of comes with everything else. It takes a lot.
Yeah, I think James and Jack, both of you guys are really in a better position to answer this than I am, right? Like James, you are currently hosting a podcast, which I'm sure was not part of your job description when we hired you. You know, you've done some amazing video work, including the epic Tudor Black Bay GMT, which people still talk about. Like you are a writer, certainly. You cut podcasts. I know you've cut this and the Graynado in the past. Like you do a lot. And I know, you know, Jack does his Hey Hodinkee thing and talking watches and Week on the Wrist, as well as appearing here and writing. So I think that's just the nature of media today. But I mean, how do you feel about it?
I think unless you have a very specific idea of what it is, like I could see saying like, my goal is to be a host, to be the person that's in front of the camera or the person that's on the microphone. And then if you were so compelling, if you had such personality and a take and had the right network of people there supporting you, that could work. And I see, you see that on YouTube for sure. But I think in many ways, whether you want to get into watches or cars or almost anything, if you're talking about media, the more that you know how to do, the higher the level of your control and perfectionism can kind of influence the media's endpoint. And that's how I see it, is if I can touch more of the knobs on you know, the dials and the switches and stuff as something goes through its processes, the more it feels like it was mine. And there's a selfishness to the way that I see some of the work, but I like it that way.
Yeah. But I think about, even if we you know, pull things back and talk about people that are far more successful than anyone here, like look at our friend Gary Sheingold, who is an incredible author, like a true author. I mean, he's out there on the road promoting his book. And he's doing signings and readings all over the world. And he's been on talk shows and he's been on our show. And to take it a step even further, you know, somebody who I mean this sincerely, a big fan of is Taylor Swift. Right? Like Taylor Swift is one of the most famous people on earth. She's a singer and songwriter. She was on Saturday Night Live over the weekend. She's released 2 films over the past 3 days. She's on TikTok and Instagram. Like, she's a singer songwriter. Does she need to do all that? Like, she kind of does. You know, does she have to? No. But like, to be the Taylor Swift that the world now knows, you do have to do that. So I don't think there's any job out there where like you have a solitary purpose and that is all that you do.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, you know, the days when you could, it's funny. I was having a conversation. Ben mentioned Nick Marino earlier, who is SVP for content for Houdinki. And I was having a conversation with him a couple of days ago, and we were talking about, you know, he spent a lot of time in the print world, spent a lot of time in the magazine world. And, you know, like the whole idea that you would have somebody, that you would have a writer file a story and then ask them to do layout for the story for a print publication. Like, what a hilariously bad idea. Like, you know, back in like 19, like back in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, like 90s, like for most of the history of print, like the whole idea that a writer would have a single word to say that would be worth listening to about how a story was laid out was like a hilariously terrible idea. Like that's not their skill set. Like people go to school to figure out how to do like layout well, and you can't do that anymore, you know? And we're in a world now where like, I mean, the three of us all have had to make decisions about who to send on a story. And like, the truth is like, do you send the guy who can just write, who's a really good writer, but who can only write? Or do you send the guy who's a good enough writer who can also take great pictures? You know, like you send the person who you are reasonably sure is going to get you what you need. That's the small, you know, that's not a pain in the ass to work with. And like, you know, if you have to figure out like, I mean, like let's say we're covering a watch event in Geneva. Okay, so we send a writer. We have confidence in them as a writer, but they can't take a picture. That means that things just became 5 times more complicated because we can't use anybody in the U.S. We have to figure out who to hire to freelance in Switzerland for us. And you know, like, I mean, Houdinki, obviously we have people that we're comfortable working with, but you know, in principle, this is like a much more complicated thing to do all of a sudden. Then you have to get pictures from them, and like maybe they're good at taking pictures, but they don't really spend enough time on Houdinki to understand what the what the standards are and the criteria are for image quality and for editing. And so that means that like maybe you have to bring somebody else in, you know, to do quality control on their images, and then their images and the copy have to go to somebody else who has to proofread the copy and who has to load the images and the copy into the site and then be able to look at the final product and say to themselves in terms of layout, which is a whole nother different skill, okay, this works. So like, imagine that situation, because now you've got like 5 different people who at least who have to have hands-on on this thing to make sure that they're producing something that is like good quality standard for the site and that you're happy with. But suppose, just for argument's sake, that you have like 1 person who can like write a good story, who could take a great picture, and who can lay a story out in the CMS and the content management system, so that it looks good, you know, when you publish. And like, if you're the editor, all you have to do is look at it and say, "Hey, this looks pretty good. Oh, there's a period missing." You know, like at that point, you've got 15 minutes worth of work out of your day, and you've like worked with 1 person instead of 3 to 4 days working with like 5 different people. And like, if you are a person who can like make your editor's life, your producer's life like that much easier, you're going to get work. And you're going to get a lot of it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And then I think it, like there's that. And like, you know, I think, you know, in my early days, I was a web designer, a writer, a photographer, an editor, all that stuff. And then, you know, when you guys came around and other folks came around, like my kind of like responsibilities got dialed back. And I think, as an example, I think everyone on this little Zoom call would fancy themselves a photographer, right? I think that's fair enough. And then you go out and you meet somebody like, I don't know, Scott Schumann, right? Who literally, you know, the sartorialist, who literally like that is what he does all day, every day. And I'm like, whoa, like that is a different level of photographer. And like being able to say like, hey, like I'm going to take a pretty cool picture and this works for the story that we're writing on the new, whatever, Omega Speedmaster. That's one thing. Or Tiffany, who's on our team, who is a professional photographer. You know, the understanding of your own limitations and how that works in kind of the greater ecosystem is really important. And we've seen people and many people that you guys certainly know that kind of came into our organization and thought they could really do everything to the nth degree. And, you know, we don't want to push anybody down, but like, you know, there's a certain like, you know, so much of what we seek to achieve with Hodinkee is really be top tier in everything that we do. And that means hiring professional photographers when we think that we can shoot it ourselves, you know, and that's myself included in that for sure.
Yeah. I mean, very humbling. You know, you mentioned Tiffany. Tiffany's very talented, and it's been really excited to see her work develop for the site and everything. But back in the day, Ben, you and I traveled to Virginia to cover the McLaren F1 for the magazine, Volume 5 of the magazine. And I remember us being distinctly butthurt that I wasn't allowed to also shoot the car. I had shot cars before at a professional level, and I didn't understand your decision. And honestly, it wasn't until I was there watching the ever-talented Josh Perez do his work that I fully understood why I was there to soak things in and develop a perspective for a story. And if I had to do Josh's job and the story, the end result would have been less. So it can make sense to divide that up and understand what people's strengths are and really just what your job is. And to listen to somebody who's been around the block before and you can learn from. In that case, Ben, that was you and it has been many times in the humbling points in my career. And I think that's good. That's how you grow and get better. And I'm very cognizant of my own, you know, shortcomings, you know, and that story turned out, I think, quite well. And certainly the images were lovely. And we had just a nice time with Josh, which is also a good day to have, right?
Josh is great. He really is.
George Daniels once said of Ferdinand Bertus, certainly he had a very high opinion of his own work. And I think that's definitely a character flaw that I share. Like, but the reality is, like, I can take an okay watch picture on a good day under controlled circumstances, you know, with like good light and a tripod. But like, I look at Tiffany's stuff, who's like a professional, like an actual professional product photographer who learned really, really, really quickly how to take not a good picture, but a great picture of a watch. And like, there was a learning curve for her too, because it's like, what do people want to see when they look, you know, what does somebody who loves watches want to see when they look at a series of pictures of watches? But like, I look at her stuff and I look at my stuff and I'm like, yeah, you know, I mean, like fake it till you make it and you never made it. You know, you can get a really long way with persistence and a really long way with paying attention to sort of the quality of what you're doing. But it's like, it's beyond a certain point, it helps to have talent. And like, I just feel like she sees stuff that I just don't.
Yeah, I mean, that's why she's here and she's doing good work for sure. So I, you know, we're nearly out of time. I want to do a little bit of a summarize. Like, obviously we're saying, I think that the word here is we recommend being a generalist, but not necessarily in terms of your perspective or your passion. Those things can be focused, and that's quite crucial probably to developing a voice and that sort of thing. Learn how to work with others if that's not something that's been required of you in the past. This isn't a job that works really well from a totally siloed sort of perspective, especially if you want to rise to a certain level, you'll be part of a team. And try and develop as many of the skills as possible, but also know when it's time to let the person who's even better at it, you know, take control of the camera or the microphone or whatever it may be. You know, if you guys were able to jump back, Ben, you had mentioned not even being sure if you would start Hodinkee. But let's say, let's get that little part out of the side so we still have this podcast in this augmented timeline I'm suggesting. If you could go back to when you were first really digging in, being a web designer and the photographer and the rest of it, and if is there anything you would want to say to yourself to try and fast track or just have a better perspective on kind of what the trajectory might be?
Yeah, I've said this probably too many times on this podcast, but bringing in guys like you earlier, you know, partners and friends and Annery and Russell and investors even, you know, people that had different perspective and different skill set. And I think realistically, like I was working way too hard on this thing for way too long. And I think that that not only, you know, really kind of stunted me personally, but I think stunted the business in a way that wasn't necessary. Like, I think Hodinkee, you know, where we are now and where we were 10 years ago, like obviously dramatically different, but like we're still the same company and we could have been here, you know, years ago. And I think, you know, certainly no regrets, but I think, you know, opening up the business and opening up what I was doing to other people sooner would have been advantageous. No question.
I mean, when you're young, you want to be a star. You want to be the star. And the truth is, that's not the way media works. I mean, it can work. It can work that way to a certain extent, but, you know, and this is just like my take on what Ben just said, but like, you know, the truth is like nobody does it alone. And I think the two biggest cutoffs that I've seen people kind of build into their own professional lives and not address is like, number one, just in general being like difficult to work with. If you're a pain in the neck to work with, sooner or later, people are going to find somebody else to work with. And, you know, kind of connected to that is that if you are part of a team, your job is to make your team look good. And if what you do is make the people that you work with feel like you have their back and make them feel like you want them to become better at what they do and like you actually, like you genuinely care about them as a person and you genuinely care about them feeling good about their quality of work and making it better, that's gonna take you a long way. And the last thing that I'll say is like writers hate to be edited. You know, like the history of every kind of writing is full of writers who are like, who the fuck are you to edit me? You know, I just read this like hilarious email thread from a guy who writes about restaurants. I'm like fascinated with restaurant writers in the UK, especially because it's like one of the most wonderfully bitter, angry genres of writing in the whole existence of consumer journalism. But there's this like guy who's a really well-known British restaurant critic who tore a sub-editor at the paper that he writes for, a new one, for taking the article A out of one of his sentences. That's like the only change he made. That's the only change that this poor schmuck made, who's probably like barely making enough to afford like getting to and from work and buying like one beer once a week. And he got this like angry, like torrentially angry, like toxically angry email, you know, from this like star writer who it's his job to edit because he like honestly made one tiny, tiny change that he thought was worth making. And like, you know, we've all done that. Like I have been like, you know, over the last 20 years, I've gotten like toxically angry a few times at people who edited me, who I feel like had no right to edit me. But like the truth is, if you're not willing to be edited, you are never going to grow as a writer. It's just not going to happen.
Well, sage advice from both of you. Thanks as always for being on the show. I think this is a fun one. I hope it helps to answer that question, which is I think a pretty common one. I get it with some frequency. How do I get into this? Where would I start? Should I start my own blog? Should I just, you know, go right to the YouTube thing? And I think follow your gut is a big one. If there's a point in the media profile that seems to suit you, go there, but don't ignore the rest of it. Try and be well-rounded.
Oh, you know what? Learn French.
Oh, that's a great one. That's a great tip. I wish I had done that even without writing about watches. I totally squandered that option that I had in high school.
Like of the three of us, none of us speak French. I have like a great French accent, but it's basically like a comedian imitating a French accent on like network TV in the 1960s.
Jack, after martini number 4 or 5, your French gets pretty good.
Yeah, but it's like after like martini number 3 or 4 or 5 after like 2 to 3 weeks in Switzerland, like that just like doesn't happen often enough to make me a French speaker.
Yeah, the sleep deprivation strengthens the extra lingual skills is for sure. Well, this has been great, guys. Thanks so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it. And if you're listening and you're enjoying it, please tell a friend. Can't ask for anything more than that. And otherwise, we'll see you in the comments and we'll chat to you next week.
Peace.